At the outset of Barbara Kingsolver's new novel, Della Robbia Turnbow, a young mother in impoverished Appalachian Tennessee, heads up the mountainside to conduct an affair and is stopped in her tracks at an incredible sight.
These were evergreen trees. They should be dark, and that wasn't foliage. There was movement in it. The branches seemed to writhe. She took a small automatic step backward from the overlook and the worrisome trees, although they stood far away across the thin air of the hollow. She reached into her purse for a cigarette and then stopped. A small shift between cloud and sun altered the daylight, and the whole landscape intensified, brightening before her eyes. The forest blazed with its own internal flame.
That flame is not fire, it's butterflies. Now, we fell in love with the monarch butterfly after seeing the new IMAX film that tells how Canadian scientist Fred Urquhart spent his life tagging them and tracking their migration. A young couple in Mexico heeded his call for help and found the mystical place where millions of butterflies winter on a mountaintop in Mexico. So, what are butterflies doing in Barbara Kingsolver's novel, Blanketing a Mountaintop in Tennessee? Barbara's novel is Flight Behavior. She joins us from the NPR studios in Washington. And Barbara, did you know that history?
Listen, do you think I could have written this novel without knowing everything about butterflies?
And then the couple in Mexico hears about this, and then they go up and they discover the mountain, and then they bring the scientist and his wife come, and they finally, his life's work, they see it, and he's just stunned, and he glances down, and there is one of his first butterflies that he tagged.
Yeah, I've pictured that scene in my mind, Fred Urquhart, and what that must have meant to him after searching. And that's that. Actually, that very story is referred to in the novel.
Have you been to Mexico to see where the monarchs are?
Of course, because I couldn't have created these visual scenes, you know, without having seen them.
Does it feel like flame or?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It feels like magic. It feels like snow. I mean, when I knew I was going to write this novel, I made a trip. And in fact, I went there the very week that the horrible flood, an unprecedented rainfall, washed away Angangueo, so completely destroyed the town where people go to see the butterflies. So I had to have this incredible adventure and hike up the backside of the mountain, and it was amazing. I didn't even know if we'd ever get there, and nobody even knew if the butterflies were still there because everything had been, there was this precipitous landslide and everything was washed away. So people kept telling us, they're gone. The monarchs are gone. This was in February of 2010. When we got there and saw them, it was doubly amazing because we weren't sure what we would find. And so I grew up chasing butterflies, and I was trained as a scientist. So this is the remarkable biological story of the monarch has been familiar to me my whole life. I never really thought of it as a device for a novel. I had been thinking for a long time about how to write about climate change and how to write about the culture war and the difficulty of conversation about climate change, which is really, that's the scope of a novel. But I couldn't figure out how to get into that. It's a very difficult subject. And then actually one morning I woke up with this vision of what looked like flame on an Appalachian mountainside. And I knew what I was looking at in my mind. I sort of dreamed this up, that this migration, instead of going to the mountains of Michoacán, where, you know, these all these butterflies have, in fact, converged.
Mexico, in real life.
Right, in Mexico. Instead, what if they all wintered suddenly in the mountains of eastern Tennessee? And I knew at that moment I had the novel.
Well, there you go. And as soon as your character, Della Robbia, sees them, she, by the way, does not have that affair, heads right back home because she's not sure what she's seen. What have I seen up
here? She thinks it's a burning bush. She thinks it's some kind of a miracle. She turned around and marched back to pick up her kids at her mother-in-law's house and tried to see her life anew.
Yeah.
But what she soon learns is that it's either a miracle or it's a disaster. It's a freak biological event that has never happened before and should not have happened, and it attracts all kinds of attention to this little town and to her. including the media and tourists and environmentalists and biologists who say this is because of climate change.
Right.
So is it something beautiful? Is it something terrifying?
And it may just be both. The Washington Post says Barbara Kingsolver may have the first great novel about climate change, but the LA Times is one review that's been critical. They say that it's preachy. Were you worried about that?
I wasn't worried about that because I don't have a clue what I would be preaching if I were a preacher. I don't have a specific outcome in mind. I'm not trying to create a particular belief system in my readers. What I wanted to do is introduce readers to why is it that people can look at something like this flame on the mountainside and say, oh, it's a gift from God, or oh, no, this is a disaster. How do we decide what to believe? That's what this novel is about. And in fact, my sympathies lie deeply with the poor, conservative, church-going farmers in this story who don't believe in climate change. So how do we talk across this divide between people who say it's the Lord's business and people who say it's carbon in the atmosphere, and it's our business.
You mentioned that there were two ways of looking at this as these beautiful burning bushes up on the mountain, which are really migrating butterflies. It could be a gift from God and a miracle, or as the biologists and your characters increasingly see it, it could be a sign that there's disaster going on because they aren't where they should be. But there's a third option, and you mentioned the poverty. If you are impoverished and those woods up there are neither of those things, they are a place where you can make money by logging, then you've got yet a third situation.
This is the issue. People all over the world are in a position of trying to get through today, trying to get a secure roof over their heads and a meal cooked for their children, that the abstraction of lowering your carbon footprint is it's just not on the table. And the people who have most in the world are the people who have put most of that carbon into the atmosphere already. So I wanted to talk a little bit about environmentalism and class, which is just really not talked about in this country. Well, in the United States, we just don't talk much about class anyway, but it's really an issue to have sympathy for the people who don't really have the options to think so much about the future and what our obligation is to them and what our obligation is to the people who aren't born yet.
Author Barbara Kingsolver, who actually trained as a biologist and brings that to bear with her mystical look at global warming in her new novel, Flight Behavior. We're taking a Friday break from the news with Barbara, but as you just heard, her book looks a lot at a lot of the news headlines, and we'll hear more about that in 1 minute, here and now. Welcome back to our conversation with Barbara Kingsolver. In her new novel, Flight Behavior, 28-year-old Delarobia Turnbow discovers millions of monarch butterflies that are supposed to be migrating to Mexico, instead wintering on her family's mountaintop in Tennessee. Is it a miracle or a sign of disaster caused by global warming? As the town wrestles with that question, familiar topics are raised. Religion, class warfare, the economy. A farmer faces foreclosure because of debt that's ballooned by accumulated interest. And there's one passage where Delarobia and her husband go Christmas shopping for their kids at the dollar store. Their 5-year-old son, Preston, is in love with the butterflies and the scientists who come to study them. Delarobia is, too. She was once an honor student. She picks up a cheap plastic pair of binoculars for Preston and thinks to herself, it's tempting to buy a horrible thing you can afford. You could pretend it actually worked and make your kids shut up and do the same. Child-rearing in the underprivileged lane. Barbara Kingsolver, that scene, you know, trolling the dollar store, many of us have been there, but as you describe her, it's heartbreaking.
Well, it's life for a lot of people. It's real life. And the poignancy in that scene for the protagonist is that she's lived her whole life in a very confined space. She got pregnant in high school. She married her husband, Cub, who's very sweet, but he's dumb as a box of rocks. She lives on her in-laws' farm. Delarobia has this very constrained world that she has to live in. And when this miracle happens that brings these scientists in from the outside, and really the sort of the whole world comes to her doorstep, she is suddenly for the first time acquainted with, oh, for example, college kids and graduate students whose shoes, she recognizes, cost more than her husband earns in a month driving the gravel truck. So she suddenly is beginning to feel embarrassed about her world and the reach of her world, and that's very, very painful.
Well, but I have to say, you also just a little bit mock these students who come in to study the butterflies, because they're astonished, for instance, that instead of them throwing away a coat that has a broken zipper, she suggests, well, I'll just put a new one in for you. And they're like, you have a sewing machine? And she says, yeah, it's not like an atom smasher or something. I mean, these are kids who wouldn't even think to repair something. And that's how far our divide is.
I really didn't think that was mocking. I would venture to say that about 95% of college students in the United States of America would not know how to replace a zipper in their winter coat. I simply wanted to point out that we are all knowledgeable in our own ways and all, you know, can be resourceful in our ways and are failing to communicate and converse about some very important things because perhaps our different worlds are too busy maligning the other side as ignorant, you name it.
Just to try to stem the tide of emails I'm going to get from college students, of course, there are college students and there are kids who are, you know, studying butterflies and might have expensive boots to do so, but they still will repair a jacket rather than throw it away. We know that.
Well, and that's my point. I was not mocking these students.
Right.
I was pointing out that they had respect for her, were in awe of Della Robbia and her sewing machine because she could fix stuff in a way that they'd never thought
about. One of the reasons that money is such an issue in the question of what to do about this flaming forest is that one of the farmers has taken out a loan on machinery that he uses, and there's a balloon payment due. And so he's desperate not to lose everything and to make that payment.
Right. And she suddenly, because of her acquaintance with these very smart kids who are devoted to this research and who are explaining to her that this is a whole species at stake, she's suddenly in a position to understand how the necessity of short-term gain can be very devastating in the long run. That's really the heart of this novel, what we have to do to get through the day, what the cost of that is in the long run, in how many ways we sort of throw our lives away. The first line of this novel, the way it begins, is this: a certain feeling comes from throwing your good life away, and it is one part rapture. I believe that the first sentence of a novel should make a promise that the book will keep. And that's the question. Why is it that we do things that we know are going to cost us dearly in the long run, but we still do them in the short run?
And that sentence that you read, that opening sentence, is when the one thing she's going to do, even though she knows it could completely destroy her life, is possibly have an affair. As we said, she doesn't. But talk about that life.
She's not just a stay-at-home mother. She's a mother who has never had a single choice since she accidentally got pregnant at 17. She lives in a hastily built little house that was thrown together by her in-laws, sort of at the occasion of the shotgun wedding. Her in-laws dictate everything about her life. Her husband makes barely enough money for them to eat. She's very trapped. Motherhood is a really large element of this novel, and it's very unsentimental. She loves her kids very much.
Loves
them. Two-year-old and a five-year-old. This five-year-old Preston, he's kind of a scientific, nerdy little kid, and he's a genius. And it breaks her heart to see that he's got so many questions and she sees a life ahead of him in which very few of them will be answered. This is not a family that's ever sent a kid to college. So as much as she loves her kids, they also drive her crazy because she never, ever leaves
the house. She can't, you know, there's no such thing as a babysitter here.
Or a health club. You know, it's not as if she's going to go to the health club. Let me read just a little of how you describe it. Being a stay-at-home mom, and again, young mom, the loneliest kind of lonely, always and never by herself. Days when she might not get completely dressed or read a word longer than checks or brush her teeth or leave a single footprint outside the house. And she watches out the window. She watches these ewes. Butt at udders of the mother so that they can eat. They butt her so hard they lift the mother lamb off the ground, and that's sort of like her life. Always people always wanting something from her.
It's a very unsentimental look at motherhood, a constrained life. And I live in Southern Appalachia. I live among people who work very hard and barely make ends meet, especially farming, because farming has become a more and more difficult enterprise economically, and especially with the change in climate. We've had one disaster year after another, so it's getting even harder to make a living as a farmer.
Drought, flooding.
Well, just for example, this year we had record drought in June. In July, we had three times our average rainfall. We had more rain in this past July than ever in the recorded history of our county. So these kind of unprecedented weather events are taking the greatest toll on farmers. And these are some of the same people who are in sort of least well situated to understand or discuss climate change. So it's a terrible contradiction that I look in the face every day because of where I live in southwestern Virginia. So that's why I had to write a novel about this subject.
That's Barbara Kingsolver. And the novel is Flight Behavior, having to do with the behavior of the butterfly, but also of people who just want to flee, run away.
Which is all of us. We all want to run away from the most difficult things.
You can read an excerpt at hereandnow.org. Barbara, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please have a great weekend. We'll be remembering our veterans, and join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software. Find over 200 job openings at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.